Today on Maine Calling, Nirav Shah on the next pandemic. As Maine CDC director during the height of the COVID pandemic, Dr. Nirav Shah guided our state through an unsettling time, through daily news briefings and regular appearances here on Maine Calling. Since then, he has served at the national CDC in Atlanta and is now back in Maine preparing for a new role at Colby College. A focus of his work now is this big question: are we ready for the next pandemic? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Nirav Shah returns to the airwaves to tackle that question. We'll discuss what he learned and what we learned about the response to the COVID pandemic, emerging diseases that concern him, and how skepticism of vaccines and institutions might affect the next public health emergency. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As much as we'd like to think that the COVID pandemic was a one-time crisis, the possibility of another global health emergency is real. Today, we welcome Nirav Shah back to Maine Calling to discuss how likely it is that we will experience another pandemic and whether or not we are prepared. Dr. Shah is the former director, as I'm sure you know, of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention. He left 2 years ago to work as the principal deputy director of the U.S. CDC. He's now back in Maine and has taken on a new role as a visiting professor at Colby College. Welcome back, Dr. Shah.
Thank you so much, Jen. It is so wonderful to be back. First of all, I can't tell you how great it is to be back home in Maine for good. And second, as you mentioned, please call me Nira, because I am back here and I am no longer serving in a medical or public health capacity. So I look forward to the discussion today.
All right. Well, we invite you to join the conversation. Do you have questions for Nirav Shah about the infectious diseases you're reading about in the news? What do you think we in society learned or didn't learn from the COVID pandemic? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. So we'll call you Professor Shah now. No, I'll call you Nira. but it's hard to believe it's 5 years since you were regularly coming on to Maine Calling to talk about this thing we were referring to, I think at the time, as the coronavirus. I remember looking up what it was called and how to refer to it and what exactly all of this meant, the letters and numbers that were going with it. And so that was 5 years ago. You led us through that and then spent 2 years in Atlanta at the U.S. CDC, the federal CDC. Tell us a little bit about what that was like working for the federal government.
Well, it was a remarkable opportunity, and I was honored to be asked to serve in that role, even though it meant leaving Maine for just a wee bit. And the issues that I worked on and were in my portfolio at the CDC are very much what we're going to be talking about today. They go under the very broad umbrella of what's called health security, which is to say, we know that there are diseases out there, and we know that there are diseases here in the U.S. that could spark the next pandemic. And we know that that risk is driven by very identifiable factors. So what can we do right now to mitigate that risk, to keep us all safe and secure? And the two things that we're going to talk about as we go through the conversation today is number one, the fact that what is predictable is preventable. And when it comes to these pandemic risks, we can predict where they might arise, what they might look like, and what impact they may have. And so because we can predict those things, we should be taking parallel steps to prevent them. And then the other thing we'll talk more at length about is that although there are biological and technological risks inherent in all of these things, the thing that really keeps me up right now in this moment is not so much the biology or the technology, it's the leadership component. Because fundamentally, our readiness is a function of our leadership capacity to be able to detect and respond when something starts.
Before we get to these big questions, just want to clarify, you're going to be teaching at Colby this fall.
That is right. I will be a visiting professor for a year at Colby College, where I'll be teaching courses on a lot of the things we're going to be talking about here. For example, I'll be teaching a more advanced course on outbreaks and epidemics, not just the biology of them, but I think what we'll also talk about today as well, which is the psychology, the sociology, and the politics. How do we remember these events after they happen? What do they tell us about the future? And I'm really excited for that course. I'm really excited to be interacting with young, smart undergraduates at a time when sometimes it looks a little bit dark on the horizon. Colleges and universities are a place of hope.
All right. Well, let's talk about what you're concerned about right now. Is it bird flu? Is it dengue? Is it measles? Talking about keeping you up at night?
All of the above choice there, because it's all of those things. And let me talk as to why, or what are the factors that I think are driving some of this risk. Number one among them are ecological factors. I break down these ecological factors by what I call the four C's. Those are crowded, convergence, connected, and climate. The world is becoming increasingly crowded, particularly in places like megacities around the world, as well as in the U.S., which puts people in closer proximity, which makes it that much easier for something to spread if it were to happen. Not just are things getting crowded, the convergence between animals and humans, the line that used to separate animals from humans has been dissolving over the past decades. And as a result of that, a lot of the diseases that we are the most concerned about are ones that circulate among animals and where we'd like to keep it that way, like Ebola and Marburg, which circulate among things like bats. But as humans and animals become more close to one another, the likelihood of that, because of that convergence of something skipping over or spilling over from animals to humans, it goes up. We're also more connected than we've ever been before. We've seen that during COVID. We see it during measles outbreaks, like you mentioned. Many of these diseases are just a plane flight away. And I don't mean an international plane flight away. In many cases, the threat is already here at home with things like bird flu, with things like measles, with things like valley fever. We don't always need to have an international introduction. Some of it can just be from here in the U.S. And then, of course, climate change affects all of those three things, and in and of itself is an independent risk for increasing where previously unheard of diseases can find a home. We've already seen that here in New England with record rates of things like Lyme disease, et cetera, because of the way that ticks are proliferating. So these ecological risks are one of the primary drivers as to why outbreaks are more common, and any one of those outbreaks could become the next pandemic.
Any one of them. You know, the big question here is how prepared are we? And as I think about this, Nirav, and you can tell me if I'm thinking about this right, there are some positives. You know, we now can develop vaccines much more quickly than we could before, in big part because of COVID and the technology that was sort of hyper fast paced during that time. And also the fact that information can travel really, really quickly. But the cons are that misinformation also travels very, very quickly. And we have this growing vaccine hesitancy movement. And so I'm wondering how you think about all of this and where you come down in the end. When something big happens again, where are we going to be as a society?
That's ultimately, Jen, the lens that I look at all of this through, which is how do any of these particular moves that you read about in the paper, some people got fired, this system was taken offline, this new development came through, how do any of those ultimately make us safer or less safe going into the future? So let's tick through some of the things you mentioned. Well, one of the areas in which we are stronger in our preparedness overall is on the technological front. I mentioned the biological risks a moment ago. But on the technological front, we've made great advancements before COVID and certainly during. You mentioned one, mRNA vaccines and a rapid platform. That said, I have concerns about recent moves to cancel some contracts by the US government to hamper our mRNA platform preparedness. Another area that we've made significant strides on, and that I was very involved with at the CDC, is the way in which diagnostic tests can be made more quickly and deployed to the field as a result. We've already been doing that with things like bird flu. So on the technological front, we've gotten a lot better and we have a sense of where we need to be able to go. But as you say, on the sociological or the psychological front, those risks are perhaps more pronounced than they've ever been. I'm going to talk about two of them. One is one you mentioned, mis- and disinformation. That is an omnipresent threat and something that is augmented by the proliferation of social media. That's just a fact. So we can do one of two things there. We can put our heads in the sand and say, oh my, this is awful. Or we can do what I've tried to urge, which is use social media for a good, even though we recognize it's got a downside. In this situation, and when it comes to misinformation, misinformation thrives when there is a vacuum. And in my, by my lights, the best antidote to misinformation is correct information, particularly if it's given in advance. So when we start to see myths proliferate, that's the time to squash them rather than before it's taken hold. Again, what's predictable is preventable. And we can predict when misinformation will take hold. That's the time to prevent it. The other sociological risk that's on my mind a lot these days is a collective amnesia. After the 1918 influenza pandemic, historians have documented how, much like the current moment we're in, everyone just wanted to forget what had happened during 1918. And it's true that after 1918, there was a rush to build hospitals and public health infrastructure, but not for several years. You didn't really see that start happening until 1925 and onward. We are in a similar moment right now. That collective amnesia makes us particularly vulnerable if something were to hit right now, because it's much harder to galvanize people to action while they are still grappling with the collective trauma that was COVID-19. And so that sociological risk is very pronounced in this moment.
Dr. Shah, a few weeks ago, we had Rick Russo, the author Richard Russo, on our program, and he has a recent book of essays called Life and Art. And I'm going to do something kind of unusual for an interview with you and read a passage from that book because Rick was talking about at the same time, and in the first essay in the book, two things were happening in his life. One was that brother-in-law who was a vaccine skeptic was in the hospital very ill with COVID in very dire condition, and of course he hadn't had a vaccine, and Rick and his wife were frustrated with that. At the same time, his father had neck pain and was. Had gone to somebody who knew who was a horse trainer and gotten something called DMSO to treat it. And so this is the what Rick writes about that. And I think it's just really interesting. I want to ask your take on it. He says, one of the problems with screaming, how could you be so stupid at people who behave stupidly, is that we too often think of the question as rhetorical when it isn't. Though vaccine hesitancy is often seen as purely political, that's not always the case. It also correlates to lack of health care, which means that when public health officials urge the unvaccinated to consult their family doctors on the assumption they might be more persuasive than government agencies, they're assuming facts not in evidence. If you can't afford health insurance, you probably can't afford a doctor either. And this is how you've been living for the last decade. Chances are you're good at surviving without sound medical advice, and that's become part of your behavioral DNA. Your strategy will be much like my father's. Keep working, save what you can for rainy day, the rainy day you know is coming, and hope for the best. Maybe you'll get lucky and know a guy. And it's the first time I had sort of connected, or I haven't connected, somebody had connected with me, health inequity to vaccine hesitancy. And I think that that's a really interesting insight.
I completely agree. And as you said in the closing line, first of all, I really appreciate that passage. And I'm very thankful to Mr. Russo, of whom I'm a big admirer, for putting that into print. Because as you noted at the end of that passage, the thrust there is that a lot of everyone wants to have a guy. And it's this desire to want to know somebody, to be in the loop on something. And why that is important is, I think it comes down to something that I have thought a lot about, which is someone came up to me a long time ago when the vaccines were first starting to be rolled out and said, "But how do you know, Nira, that the vaccine works?" And I had to acknowledge that that was a good question because I wasn't involved in any of the research. I'm not a laboratory scientist. I wasn't doing the clinical trials. How did I know that the vaccines worked? And the answer was that I am part of a chain of trust. I went to places and studied with people and professors and classmates who are involved in these things, and I know the moves that they make, the journals they publish, the protocols they use, the lab studies that the FDA looks at, such that for me, I was able to evaluate the vaccine because I have been part of that chain of trust. But not everyone is part of that chain of trust. Indeed, for a lot of vaccine skeptics, they're part of a different chain of trust, a chain of trust that relies on knowledge from social media and friends rather than others. And so when we think about preparedness for the next pandemic, communication and equity, this piece of knowing that everyone comes to the discussion with a different chain of trust is absolutely paramount. Now, let me say that it's commonplace in this moment to think of misinformation as a doom and gloom, an insurmountable barrier to being truly prepared for the next pandemic. I flatly disagree with that. And the data from Maine demonstrate that when communication is undertaken carefully, thoughtfully, deliberately, and compassionately, misinformation can be overcome. Maine is one of the most vaccinated places in the country, if not the world. By the end of the first booster period, Maine was the most vaccinated state in the country, notwithstanding the fact that people here believe in misinformation in the way that they do everywhere around the globe. But because of the way that we approach communication, we were able to overcome it. That is a playbook for other states as we think about being prepared for the next pandemic.
We are, though, 5 years from the start of the last pandemic, and boy, this country is a lot different, a very different place, if anything, a more divided place. Does that worry you?
It does. The polarization of this moment could impair our ability to respond effectively. There has been recent survey data that has come out about the way that Americans trust the advice of the CDC, particularly under Secretary Kennedy. And what those poll data show is somewhat nuanced. On the concerning side, net of net, more people will lose trust in the advice of the CDC than who will gain trust. But there too, there are a certain segment of the population that will believe in the words of the CDC even more under Secretary Kennedy. They are outweighed by the number of folks who will lose trust. And so, right at the top, right now in this moment, we would go into a pandemic were one to occur in a trust deficit. That said, not all hope is lost. I remain an eternal optimist. And the reason I say that is that even in some of these survey data, they point the way toward broad areas of mutual agreement between skeptics as well as those who are embracing the CDC, whether it's around substance use, chronic disease, et cetera. Now, none of those is the same as pandemic preparedness advice, but they are the pathway toward continuing dialogue that might actually help us get there when we need to. But make no mistake, polarization is definitely a risk that we face that's more pronounced than it was even 5 or 6 years ago.
Given all the changes recently, are you confident that the CDC will give the advice that people need to be listening to, will give the proper advice?
I am confident. I remain in close contact with my colleagues who are there. And notwithstanding some of the things we've all seen in the press and some of the moves that have been made, much of the core science that is undertaken, which is done by career scientists, That work continues. The publication of that work continues, even though there were some rocky moments back in January and February. And so, for example, the CDC just published some recent data on H5. So I am confident that the career scientists remain committed to that work and will continue to publish it. If that assessment changes, I will certainly let everyone know. But right now, I continue to have great faith in the ability of the CDC to do the right thing and to publish the right data.
You recognize the voice. We're speaking with Nirav Shah on Maine Calling. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The COVID pandemic no longer dominates our daily life, and many have put it behind them. But the big question now, are we prepared for another pandemic? Joining me to try to answer that question, Nirav Shah. You know his name, Maine's former CDC director. He was central to the state pandemic response. And then he worked in leadership at the federal CDC for 2 years and is back in Maine now, getting ready to teach for a year at Colby College. We invite you to join the conversation. You can, of course, send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Shah, we'll start by going to Marie calling from South Portland. Hi, Marie. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm immunocompromised and have to wear a mask and had cancer during the pandemic. Facilities were not kept safe for us. Public messaging was not accessible for people with disabilities. In fact, Disability Rights Maine report stated that it was likely so inaccessible people with disabilities didn't know how to keep ourselves safe. How are people going to do it differently this time? And thank you for changing your content on Twitter to alt text because I tagged you online, but it did not lead to changing the CDC messaging, which is what was needed.
Well, thank you, Marie. And I know you, it sounds like you've had to grapple with a lot. So I'm really pleased to hear you on the other side of all of this. But you raise a really critical point, two critical points. One is that COVID exposed, any pandemic, frankly, exposes the weakest parts of our society. It lays them bare for all to see. Whether it's COVID or any other pandemic that the world has ever experienced. And so the spotlight that you've shown on the inability of our typical public health and healthcare system to adequately account for, communicate with, and provide care for individuals with disabilities is something that is of significant risk going forward. I am hopeful that we will have learned from some of those, certainly on the communication front, whether it's on access or making messages more equally available. But make no mistake, we have a long way to go on the biological front. Again, one of the most devastating aspects of a pandemic is that individuals who are able to wall themselves into their own houses may fare a lot better than folks who continue to have to be exposed, whether because of their work or who are differentially at risk because of their immune status. That is really tragic. And I'm hoping that many of the technical advances that we've made in biological treatments, more rapid diagnostics, will even the playing field so that even folks who are immune compromised will not suffer at the same degree that they have in historical pandemics.
Marie, thanks so much for your call. One thing you mentioned earlier, Dr. Shah, is that the idea of being able to develop testing more quickly. And I sort of had a flashback in remembering how long people had to wait for tests at the beginning and how they had to have a certain set of medical conditions to even qualify for a test. But there was also this shortage of PPE. And Marie mentions that she still wears a mask everywhere she goes. Do you have confidence that that won't happen again, that hospitals will stay well stocked, that people will be able to buy masks at their local Walgreens or CVS? You're shaking your head right now. No.
I don't have confidence in that, Jen, to be totally candid with you, for a few reasons. One is that it goes back to this amnesia piece. I think for the most part, Marie is an exception because of her medical status. But for the most part, folks are done with PPE. And thus, the places where it might be stockpiled, whether on the government side, the hospital side, or at your local drugstore, they're wondering what they're doing with warehouses full of PPE when no one wants it or needs it. Secondly, PPE, like all medical products, has a lifespan, and it can't sit on the shelf indefinitely. At some point, it's got to be tossed out because the elastic doesn't work anymore or the fabric breaks down a little bit. And so a concern that I have, and I've chatted with our colleagues at the federal government as well as at the Department of Defense, is what is the appropriate amount of PPE that we need to have on hand in case the next pandemic arises? But I am concerned that in the earliest phases of the next pandemic, we will be in a similar situation where states are still scrambling on their own to find the PPE that they must need. This to me goes back to what I said at the top. Many of the risks that we are facing right now, the ones that really keep me up at night, they're not biological or technical, they're leadership. And without competent leadership at all levels of government, we run a high risk of repeating the errors of the first days of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Do you have personal advice for all of us? Do you, you know, if we have a box of masks in the storeroom or in the bathroom closet, do you recommend holding on to it? I mean, you said it only has a certain amount of a shelf life. But would you give us all of us the advice to maybe keep some masks and gloves and a couple other things on hand, some hand sanitizer?
Good. So let me first start by contextualizing the risk that we're facing in this moment. Right now, the risk of any of the scary diseases that you hear about, whether it's avian influenza, Ebola, Marburg, Nipah virus, what have you, the risk of any of those right now in Maine today is low. Just to be very clear, I am not on the air today saying that bird flu is stalking us as we speak. It might, and that's what's keeping me up at night. But right now, in this moment, the risk of all of those remains low. But again, time is the fifth dimension when you think about risk of pandemics. All of this can change. And so I do think it's prudent to keep on hand supplies that are useful today, as well as into the future. And so masks, even though they have a shelf life, may not be a bad idea to keep on hand. Gloves, always a good thing to keep on hand for first aid and other purposes. Likewise with hand sanitizer. So I look for things that I can use today if there's a cut or an accident, as well as things that might be needed into the future. All of these things, again, have a shelf life, so you got to check the expiration dates. But I'm not suggesting that in this moment, anybody goes out there and builds a bunker and starts stockpiling and prepping for the next pandemic. We should be alert, not alarmed.
All right. We'll go to Afton calling from Brunswick. Hi, Afton. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Nirav, it's a real honor to speak to you because I was a frontline healthcare worker when the pandemic started and throughout the duration. And it was very scary. And when I would tune into your broadcast, you really were just trying to teach and grow empathy and compassion. And it gave me kind of a rock in amongst a lot of uncertainty because I was like, I've got those skill set. I can use that. We can just use the things that we know how to do to survive this moment. So I really thank you for boiling it down and giving names to the victims and really trying to grow that. And I think that there is also a public health strategy in if we can grow empathy and compassion, then we can get public compliance with some of these public distancing things. Now, my question for you is, over the past about year and a half, maybe longer, we've also had a real concerted effort to cultivate some callousness towards Palestinian deaths in Gaza. And does that callousness to their mortality rate undermine our empathy and compassion towards one another? And is it something that you guys consider in public health as something of importance?
First, thank you so much, Afton, for your kind words. That really makes my morning. And so I really appreciate you sharing that. That's really meaningful. And I should say it was an honor to serve in that time. And I'm glad, I'm forever gratified in the way that people across Maine came together. And as I mentioned a moment ago, the numbers speak for themselves. And so thank you for noting that, Apton. Now, you raise a broader question about the way in which people can become sensitized, or in this instance, desensitized to significant horrific events, particularly when the numbers are so large. COVID is a similar phenomenon. I mean, a million people died, and we barely even talk about that statistic. It is similar, if not significantly greater, than the number of people who have died in the Civil War, the Vietnam War, or as you mentioned, the crisis in Gaza. And we are at risk in these situations of the numbers being so staggering, the significant number of hospitalizations, the significant number of deaths, as to tune them out, because in a sense, they can't be real. There's a sense in which small numbers are relatable. Small numbers of deaths are relatable, but large numbers of deaths become so unrelatable as to make people say, well, I'm not sure that that's even real. And we run that risk in the next pandemic, similar to 1918. Indeed, going back all the way to the Black Death, 600-700 years ago, historians have documented how people essentially just gave up because the numbers were so staggering. And that is absolutely an informational risk that we have to figure out how to get over.
You know, that's so interesting as you said that, that a small number of deaths is more relatable than a large number of deaths. I'm thinking about people who won't swim in the ocean because they're afraid of sharks, but they might not get a COVID vaccine. So it's really interesting.
You know, when we think about the next pandemic and how to process it, I've already talked about predictability and preventability, the leadership, but this business of the way in which humans process risk is critical. And let's be clear, humans are terrible at processing risk. A lot of people evaluate the likelihood of something that's a 1 in a million chance and a 1 in a billion chance as being basically the same, even though they are 1,000-fold different. Humans are very, very poor at processing risk. Nobel Prizes have been awarded for this. But it matters when we think about the next pandemic, because right now we are in a world where people fear the risk of vaccines more than the risk of the underlying disease that they are designed to prevent. And if that inability to calculate risk and odds persists, we may be on our back heels for the next pandemic. Hopefully not here in Maine, because I think we've laid the groundwork for talking about these things. But in other parts of the world, that could be a significant barrier.
Afton, thank you for your call. We'll move to Harrison and Mary Ellen. Hi, Mary Ellen. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Shah. It's nice that you just talked about risk, because that is what I was going to begin with. I want to tell everyone I know the importance of taking a vaccine, because people think that, oh, it's a mild flu and I'm healthy and I'm fine. Well, it's not all about you. And I had a mild case at the beginning, before there were any tests, and I was coughing for 2 weeks, and I went to my doctor when I spiked a fever, and he had me go for chest x-ray because I'm 82. I'm a retired RN, and I've seen people my age die from pneumonia. It's often the beginning of the end. So I want to tell young people, if you don't get one, get it for your grandmother, you know, and I'm still suffering now with a long COVID. I never got better, and he said, I think you have long COVID. So my quality of life is way down, and it's not funny. So people have to think of the after effects, not just the initial illness. And thank you for all your good work. I used to listen to you all the time.
Mary Ellen, I'm so sorry to hear that you're struggling. Nirav, yeah, I mean, I think this is kind of related to the last question where she was talking about empathy, you know, empathy and selfishness are
absolutely
endemic in our culture. Go ahead.
Yeah, and Mary Ellen, thank you for raising that. And as Jennifer mentioned, I'm sorry that you're grappling with long COVID, but I'm going to keep a prayer in mind for you because there's hope on the horizon. But you raise a really important question about why humanity matters. And it's one reason why when we think about the next pandemic, we can't forget the fact that it's ultimately humans and animals and our friends and our family who are going to be affected. And as I think about where Maine is situated for the next pandemic, notwithstanding the risks that I've mentioned, I think Maine is in a strong place. And here's why. Mary Ellen, what you got at, you know, do it for others, to me comes down to the most important question that is facing us right now, not just with pandemics, but with every single policy issue on the horizon. Every single social issue, to me, can be boiled down to one question, and that is, what do we owe each other? And increasingly, it's becoming fashionable for the answer to that question of what we owe each other to be nothing. We don't owe each other anything. And I've seen that rhetoric. We've all seen that rhetoric around the country, around the world. But I don't think that's the case in Maine. And I think the reason that Maine fared comparatively better in the last pandemic and is in a strong place for whenever the next one comes is that in Maine, the answer to what we owe each other is that we owe each other something, whether that's getting a vaccine to protect elders in your community or doing your part to give people who are disabled an extra hand because they can't make it outside. In Maine, people owe something to each other. And that's why I'm hopeful for how we will fare in the next pandemic.
Mary Ellen, thank you so much for your call, and I wish you the best. We are going to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we are talking about the likelihood of another pandemic and whether or not we as a society are prepared for it. With me, Nirav Shah, formerly with the Maine CDC and the federal CDC. He's going to be teaching at Colby College this fall. We have a little bit of time left. You can share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll head to Kittery and Susan. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. So this is a situation, and Mr. Shaw knows this. If you eat a dead animal, which you call meat or chicken or fish or whatever, you're going to be sick. This has been known for thousands of years. Eating dead bodies and body products from animals. We're humans. What type of animal? But we're not supposed to be eating them. It causes diseases. It causes cancers. And it's a big factor in the pandemic.
Yeah, Susan, thanks so much for your call. Dr. Shaw, would we all be a lot safer if we were vegans?
Well, I'll say two things. I'm not going to comment on the dietary aspects because, of course, there's a rich debate about the health benefits or of one path versus the other. But from a pandemic risk perspective, our friend in Kittery does make an important point, two important points. One is that, you know, if you were to ask most scientists at the CDC, what specifically is keeping you up at night from a pandemic risk perspective? They would say it's these so-called wet markets that exist in many places in the world. Markets with live animals that are in close proximity with different kinds of species, as well as with humans. And before anybody thinks that these only exist in far-flung places in distant parts of the world, that is not true. There are wet markets in the United States. There are bird markets in California. There are wet markets in New York, et cetera. These things exist here in the United States. And so those areas where different kinds of species are interacting with each other and then humans are thrown into the mix are perfect opportunities for these sorts of spillovers, whether it's Ebola, whether it's a coronavirus, whether it's influenza. All of those genetic material can swap and unfortunately can precipitate the next pandemic. That is one area of concern. Another area that the caller spotlights indirectly is the role of factory farming. Factory farming, for example, in the current moment with respect to bird flu in the United States, is a driver of potential pandemic risk. Right now, something that's unfolded in recent years with bird flu is that avian influenza has worked its way into dairy cows. Many of these dairy cows are kept in close proximity to one another, where the virus can spread either from cow to cow or through the milking equipment. These sorts of situations where the viruses are finding new animals, what are called hosts, to hitch a ride on, are magnified when we think about situations that involve factory farms or these wet markets. Now, some people say that the solution is to go back to a kinder, gentler era of backyard farming. But those too have significant risks because the biological security at those casual backyard farms is not nearly as sophisticated as what it is. So I'm not sure what the answer is. Right now, I think the most important step is to characterize the risk and be ready for whatever comes our way.
All right. Susan, thank you for your question. We'll go to Mari, who's calling from Waldoboro. Hi, Mari. Go ahead.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. Mine is fairly straightforward, I think. Dr. Shah, Nirav, I'm wondering what kind of guidance you would give people who are coming down with colds and maybe bronchial kinds of symptoms in terms of taking COVID tests. And if you suggest that we continue to take tests to see if we have COVID, what would you say about the COVID tests that are sitting, at least in my bathroom cabinets, that are maybe expired by 6 months, perhaps a year?
Mari, great. Thanks, Mari, for that question. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Shah.
Yep. No, thank you, Mari. That question comes up a lot. I'm glad you raised it. Let me first just address your question very directly. If you've got a cold, it's still worth taking a COVID test because unlike a garden variety cold, there are treatments that are available for COVID and your doctor can get them to you very quickly. And so there is a benefit to taking a test for COVID. Now, what about the expired tests? This is a little bit of legwork, but generally speaking, the expired tests are still okay, but you need to check. And the FDA has, or as of a couple months ago, had a part of its website where you could type in the serial number that's on the back, and it would tell you, yep, this one's okay, even though it's past the expiration date. And so I still think there's value in testing because there's a treatment for COVID that's available. Let me zoom out really quickly, though, because these tests, these at-home tests, we talked about this earlier, they are a key part of our readiness infrastructure. And one of the projects that we worked on a lot at CDC is having a speedboat for the next pandemic that takes the virus and immediately makes a test for it. Not a test that's a fancy one that only a couple of labs can do, but a test that every lab in the country can do, the places where we all go to get our blood tests done, as well as a process to make those converted to at home. And so being able to get more rapid diagnostics out in the field, our goal is within the first 60 to 90 days, will really help get a handle on the pandemic. As you saw with COVID, it took months for the U.S. government to get its testing act together, and that set us back compared to other countries.
Mari, thanks for your call. Let's see, we'll move to Harmony and Fritz. Hi, Fritz. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question, Dr. Shah. My question is, once the vaccine was available, what I want to know is those who lost their lives after the vaccine was available, how many had the vaccine percentage-wise and how many did not have the vaccine? My question is, you know, was the vaccine that great or was it so-so or what was it?
Good question. Great. We're learning a lot, Dr. Shah. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's such a great question, Fritz. Let me divide up the answer this way. Before the vaccine came out, the death rates really didn't vary too much. But once the based on whether you did X or Y, they varied a little bit. But a lot of what we were doing before the vaccine was managing the best we could. But after the vaccine, you see a significant difference in who is dying. In effect, sir, those who died after the vaccine were overwhelmingly unvaccinated. Now, I want to be clear. I didn't say 100%. Nothing is 100%. Did some people who got the vaccine die? Absolutely. Did some people who didn't get the vaccine survive? They did. But overwhelmingly, the one thing that people who died had in common was that they didn't have the vaccine. I'm going to post on Twitter maybe this afternoon a chart with all of the data looking back that summarizes it. But to answer your question, sir, the bottom line is that the vaccine was remarkably effective. It blew my expectations away, and that's because of the technological advances that were made. We should be so lucky to have these technologies at our disposal now, because without them, who knows where we would be.
Fritz, thank you for the question. We are going to go to Karen, who's calling from Pembroke. Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Hey. So good to talk to you. I listen to you almost every day. And so happy to hear Dr. Shaw. I worked in healthcare in 2020. Our lives were turned completely upside down. But his voice, I'm hearing his voice today. So his voice was like this steady, yes, we're going to do it. We'll get through it. And so I guess I'm just calling to say thank you.
Wow. Well, thank you for saying that. Again, I can't tell you how meaningful that is. We're in this moment when public service is viewed as, why should I serve in government when I can go to an investment bank and make a lot of money? And to me, this is an example of why public service matters, because the work that public servants across Maine, across the government do is truly out there saving lives. And I'm so thankful for you to say that, because I wasn't the only one. I just had the privilege of speaking for a cast of thousands that was doing the work to keep people safe. And so really who you're thanking is the scores of people across Maine, healthcare workers, Maine CDC staff, who really did the work to keep people safe. I just had the privilege of being able to give voice to their work. So thank you for saying that. It really, truly makes my afternoon.
And Karen, you're not alone. Thank you. Messages on Facebook from Dave. The good doctor availed many a degree of comfort through the pandemic. Thank you. And Lucy, thank you, Dr. Shaw. I'm 74 and so happy to not be sick. I'm a retired RN and pro-vaccine. So all sorts of thank yous coming in right now. We just have a couple minutes left. And one thing I wanted to ask you, Dr. Shaw, is there anything in a couple minutes, anything you do differently? For example, would you have recommended masking earlier? Or do you believe in retrospect it was the right thing to require every healthcare worker to be vaccinated?
Great. I'm so glad you raised that, Jennifer. And the answer is yes. There are so many things I would have done differently. And anyone, any leader who goes through a significant event and says, man, I nailed that, they are not a leader to be trusted. I made a lot of mistakes. And just like and that's because we faced a significant adversary. It's like a batter who bats 1,000. That just tells me that they just haven't faced a strong pitcher. So yes, I made scores of mistakes, and I am not worse for them. I am wiser for them. We all are. So let me just tick through a couple that you sort of referenced. Would I have recommended masks sooner? In retrospect, sure. It was, as you all recall, a time of unknowns. Did masks ultimately make the significant difference, as Fritz was asking earlier, between life and death? Not as much. So I'm not as sold on masks being recommended sooner. Do I think asking healthcare workers to be vaccinated, making it a condition of their employment? Yes, that's a decision I stand by. And then again, the numbers show that our aggregate nursing home and hospital deaths were lower than other places, in part because people weren't getting COVID when they came to the hospital. With respect to schools, I think there's a lot of discussion that we need to have about schools. I would have done things differently. That doesn't mean that the critics who say we shouldn't have done anything to protect kids doesn't mean that they are right. But certainly there's room for introspection. And any leader who tells you otherwise is not really learning from their mistakes.
Yeah, really important lessons to learn and a lot to study. We could talk and talk and talk, but we're out of time. Nirav Shah, thank you so much for joining us today, and I hope you'll be back. Nirav Shah served as director of Maine CDC and as principal deputy director of the U.S. CDC and is now a visiting professor at Colby College. Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we learn about artist Joseph Fiore as a new exhibit and documentary film celebrate his work. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.